This Texas Matters podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, leading Alzheimer's researchers on the fight against the disease, how to reduce your risk, and reasons for optimism in beating Alzheimer's. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. According to the Alzheimer's Association, an estimated 5.7 million Americans of all ages have Alzheimer's. This number includes an estimated 5.5 million people age 65 and older, and approximately 200,000 individuals under the age of 65 who have early onset Alzheimer's. One in 10 people 65 and older has Alzheimer's dementia. As the number of older Americans grows rapidly, so too will the number of new and existing cases of Alzheimer's. Today, someone in the United States develops Alzheimer's every minute, but in about 30 years, someone in the U.S. will develop the disease every 30 seconds. Currently, Alzheimer's is not preventable and not treatable, and it is fatal. In 2018, the direct cost for caring for those with Alzheimer's was an estimated $227 billion. By 2050, it's projected to cost more than $1 trillion. If you are counting on being one of those who does not get diagnosed with Alzheimer's, take note, then you are likely to become an Alzheimer's caregiver. And Alzheimer's takes a devastating toll on caregivers. However, there is incredible research now underway to find ways to early identify, treat, and prevent Alzheimer's. This week, the leading national and international Alzheimer's researchers gathered in San Antonio to discuss the latest developments in fighting the brain-stealing disorder. I was invited to take part in leading a public conversation by the UT Health San Antonio's Glenn Biggs Institute for Alzheimer's and Neurodegenerative Diseases and the Alzheimer's Association as they kicked off the inaugural South Texas Alzheimer's Conference. The panel includes Dr. Maria Carrillo of the Alzheimer's Association, Dr. Gladys Maestre of the Memory Disorder Center, UT Rio Grande Valley, Dr. Ken Kosk, UC Santa Barbara, Dr. Nicolas Garmias, Columbia University, Dr. Alan Peterson, UT Health San Antonio, Operation Strong Star, Dr. Robert Gracie, President Emeritus, Texas Biomedical Research Institute, Dr. Mary Ganguly, University of Pennsylvania, and Dr. Lisa Schulman, University of Maryland. I started off by asking the panel, what's the difference between brain function of someone who is just aging and someone who is dealing with Alzheimer's?
On a practical, everyday level, in normal aging, we lose some cognitive skills, but we lose just a little bit. In dementia, it's a more profound loss of skills in terms of memory, orientation. So you can think of it like, in terms of mobility. As we grow older, we run slower or we can only walk, but it's not really an orthopedic disease. But if we get a knee problem, a degenerative knee problem, then that's a disease. So in terms of everyday skills, it's a matter of degree. And of course, it's related to different changes in the brain. In normal aging, we don't see the changes in the brain that we have in Alzheimer's disease.
Is aging and dementia, are they yoked? Are you going to have one with the other?
This is Maria Carrillo with the Alzheimer's Association, and what Dr. Scarmias has said is true. There is a very big difference, and I think that speaks to your question. This is not normal aging, right? And there is a disease that we know, and Dr. Alzheimer actually saw under the microscope. But now we know so much more that there are also other related dementias and so many other things changing as we age that contribute to what would be non-normal, non-healthy aging to healthier aging. I mean, we see super agers. We see people that are in their 90s and very active. You also see that there are people in their 60s who maybe your loved ones, like I've experienced in my family, who have dementia, and it's a very big difference, right? So this is not normal aging. And at ALZ.org, there's a lot of things that you can look at to show the 10 signs of Alzheimer's or related dementia so that you can see what's normal, what might be worried well and, you know, forgot my keys because I didn't sleep so well or I'm stressed and I'm running around versus something that's actually really concerning that maybe you should take to your physician.
Yeah. I would just add to that. There are many different kinds of dementia, and we are now beginning to be able to distinguish between those kinds, and the follow-up or the procedures we would follow are different from those, for example, Parkinson's. And there are cases of mixed causes. There's mixed dementias where a person may have two or more of these underlying problems.
So the way I usually explain this is, after the age of 30, we're not getting any smarter. You know how little kids learn so much new stuff every day and they can remember it, and they just keep doing that till they're about 30, and then it kind of levels off and slows down. So everybody is going downhill a little bit with aging, and what we lose most of all is speed, so we can do pretty much everything we used to as long as they give us enough time. But sometimes they don't give us enough time. But after the age of 60 or 65, maybe 5% of people, 1 in 20 people, have something more than just normal aging. And the older we get, the bigger that percentage. So by age 90, it's maybe 30, 50%. But that's still 50 to 70% of people over 90 who don't have anything really serious in terms of dementia. But dementia is when we lose enough mental functioning that we can't function independently. That's kind of the cutoff between mild cognitive impairment and dementia, is when we lose our independence in everyday functioning because of loss of memory and other mental functions. And it's just something for the young people in the room to remember if you're past 30.
All right, so, and Lisa, you wanted to answer.
Yes. Thank you. You know, it's a really important question because actually both Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease generally are diagnosed quite late because people do get confused about, oh, I'm slowing down either cognitively or motorically, and they are blaming it on aging. And so it's not uncommon to be diagnosing people in my area of Parkinson's disease many years after the problem began. And I think in Alzheimer's, there's also quite a bit of a delay at times. So it's not trivial.
Gladys Maestre from University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley. I think that when memory changes and cognitive changes begin, they are very personal. Only you know. You know something has changed. But we kind of justify, and most of the time, you know, has to do with sleep, with stress, with age. And then becomes not only personal, but somebody notices. This has impact in your daily activities, a little bit, you know, wasting money, losing valuable things, and then perhaps the spouse notices, you know, and then or the kids or the secretary. Somebody else notices. And then what I usually see is that when the disease progresses particularly fast, then the person that has the memory problem is not worried anymore, you know. And the spouse, for example, gets getting worried and, you know, like, wow, this is getting, you know, and then, oh, no worries, I'm fine. And then when they go to the doctor, the patient is kind of relaxed and in the back is like, no, you know. So it begins as a very personal experience, and that's why we need to be aware where we are in life and how are we managing our life. You know, it has to do with our culture, with the way our values, but also has to do with being aware and also being in touch with significant others that are genuinely concerned about our quality of life. And sometimes you get, with age, we can get stubborn about, you know, I want to be independent, I don't want to get, you know, like inspire, you know, negative feelings. So it requires a lot. I agree that we don't get faster with age, but I do believe we get smarter and wiser in a way.
So Dr. Shuda and then Dr. Ken.
I just wanted to, it is very hard to recognize that one might be losing this essential part of oneself. JAMA has a very moving essay by two physicians who shared a practice, and the wife began suspecting that her husband had early onset dementia. And the challenge of facing that, confronting him with that, having him accept. So all I can say is to all of you who are going through such difficult worries, please, you have a partner. We have counselors, we have neuropsychologists. If you're worried, reach out, reach for help to your primary care physician or to Biggs. Thank you.
Right. So Dr. Kin-Kosick, I want to hear your answer, but I also want to supplement the question asking, could we have some sort of benchmarks that people could take when they feel like they're at their normal state, either through like a video game or some sort? I know that there are high schools with the resources that do that with their high school football and soccer players in order to test for concussions later on. If we can establish your normal state, then we can detect when you may have some sort of degradation.
Right, so thank you for the adding to the question. It was pretty much what I wanted to say, which is that at some point, all of us will probably worry about having Alzheimer's disease. Gladys made a very nice point as about this personal feeling before even anyone notices. And therefore, there is something that I would suggest that we do, which is simply get neuropsychological testing, because Alzheimer's is a progressive disease. So if you are worried about it and then you get the testing and you haven't changed in 6 months, you're okay. That would be, I think, the most simple way to handle this this problem.
The other issue, we know there's genetic testing and people can choose whether or not they want to hear whether or not they have those markers that put them at a high risk. And then they say, I don't want to know because there's nothing that can be done if once I know. Is that not the open mindset that we want to encourage in our society? Should people know? Yes.
I can start, and I think there are going to be a lot of great answers on this panel, and I'm honored to be a part of it. I can share with you that, first of all, on a personal side, my husband is at risk, as I am, as we age, but my husband in particular, his mother is the third of four siblings to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's dementia and to have passed away of it. And his father passed away just a few months ago as well of the same thing. So we know that we think about this a lot in his family. We think, I have four children, and my four children ask me, well, what's this mean for Dad? What's this mean for us? Did we inherit something? So we think about this genetic testing issue, and we all know that there's opportunities to get that for $99 for Christmas or for your Father's Day gift, you know? Yeah, there's all kinds of people selling you things on TV. But the only thing that I would say is that what we have followed is advice that the Alzheimer's Association has given, and it's on our website, because we just want to make sure people are making educated decisions about this very personal thing, and be aware that in the future, certainly health insurance, but today life insurance and long-term care insurance are not protected from asking you questions about your genetic risk factor. So just be careful when you make those decisions. You know what you're deciding to do and to know about. And then I think it's important for us all to think about what it means to our loved ones. So what we call consanguinity, right? You're related to people that may also, this may also impact, this news may impact. So you have to decide how you're going to share this. And talking to a genetic counselor would be a very good idea. So we have a website for that as well, because it might impact your children, it impacts your siblings. Everything you find out impacts those that are related to you. So those are the things that I would caution, and that's what we think about when we make our decision about getting a genetic risk test for our family.
I think that how people answer that question will change once we have a truly effective, targeted, disease-modifying treatment. We don't at the moment. And so having this knowledge is just something that you carry with you. And we know that everybody, whether they have a genetic marker or not, should be exercising and eating right and dancing and sleeping and doing all those things you recommended without knowing what your genetic markers are. But there's this one small subgroup of people who have the autosomal dominant genes where if you have that gene, you're going to get the disease, and lots of people in your family had it, and they probably know even without getting the testing because the family history is so strong, but there are drug trials being done in people like that.
This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. We're listening to a panel discussion recorded at the inaugural South Texas Alzheimer's Conference hosted by UT Health San Antonio's Glenn Biggs Institute for Alzheimer's and Neurodegenerative Diseases and the Alzheimer's Association.
Dr. Nicholas, you talked about the importance of exercise. Also, Dr. Ken, you did too. Maybe get both your answers on this. So do we know, I mean, not all of us are, I mean, when you exercise, I'm going to go run a marathon tomorrow. That's not really the solution. It's like, what kind of exercise? Are we talking about high intensity exercise where I really get my heart rate up? Or can I just try and just get a light sweat going? What works? What is enough exercise?
And the recommendations there are 150 minutes to 300 minutes per week of moderate of aerobic exercise of moderate intensity. If you do vigorous exercise, you can drop that down to just 150 minutes rather than go for the 300. That's the recommendation that's been coming from all the various health services nationally for a number of years. You can take it one step further, that in addition to aerobic exercise, it's probably a good idea to do some weight training, because if you can build a little bit of muscle mass and some bone strength, you also not only protect yourself from Alzheimer's, but muscles use up glucose and you protect yourself from diabetes as well.
Dr. Nicholas, and more on that. And also, is it the blood pumping and helping the capillaries get more oxygen to these extreme parts, or is there some sort of hormones being released? What's going on there?
Yeah, the mechanism, there are many links between exercise and thinking, memory, cognition, Alzheimer's disease. There are studies that suggest that certain factors in our brain that have neuroprotective effects are upregulated when you have exercises. There are genes that are, again, have such neuroprotective effects that are upregulated also, are expressed to a higher level. So there are many different mechanisms. There are links with metabolic status in the brain, with oxidation, with inflammation. So, I think the current evidence has been summarized pretty well.
Okay. So, I mean, can I get the same effect from riding a roller coaster? That's going to get my heart pumping too. But Lisa Schill?
Okay, well, in the exercise trials that we've done at the University of Maryland, we've learned some interesting things. We didn't try roller coasters, but we did compare what we call lower intensity treadmill exercise to higher intensity. And interestingly, we found that our patients tend to be so sedentary, talking about couch potatoes in their lifestyle, that the lower intensity exercise, which was just walking longer distances at comfortable paces, was in fact very aerobic for our patients. So that was really interesting. And another thing we learned that was also quite surprising, I guess, is that you can spend months working out on a treadmill, but you don't actually improve your muscle strength. You're improving your fitness and your endurance and your gait speed, but not your muscle strength. So we found, as others have found, that you need to do resistance exercise and muscle strengthening exercise to increase and improve strength. And these things aren't trivial. They're important for reducing risk of falls and maintaining ambulation.
But we'd love to go down the path and hear from each of y'all about why you are optimistic and what is it that you're looking forward to. And so, Dr. Lisa Schulman, if you could sort of talk about your optimism and where we are. Because I think it's important, because if we have this fatalistic attitude as we go towards society, we know people tend to put their head in the sand and try to wish it away. We need to let everyone know this can be beaten.
You know, actually, I've been a neurologist caring for people with neurodegenerative diseases for 25 years. And I can say with all honesty that this is a time of more optimism than any time in the past. There are more fresh and innovative approaches to neurodegenerative disease by far than there ever have been before. And so, you know, I have a lot of optimism in terms of some of these things coming to pass to really make a difference. Because if I go back to the early years of my career when I was participating in clinical trials, we were doing things that were much more kind of copycat kinds of stuff rather than real true innovation. The one note of caution, though, I would balance these comments with is that, you know, we've heard so many things about what every one of us can do to reduce our risk and to delay, hopefully, progression of dementia and other neurodegenerative problems. And that requires people actually taking this to heart, being proactive in implementing these things, you know, each of you on your own. And the truth is that up till now, that has not been the case. Even if you look at the cardiac area, how many years we've known that cardiac rehabilitation and exercise is so important in that area, yet even there, the majority of cardiac patients are not participating in exercise and other healthy habits.
There are many, many elements of optimism. The major one is, it may sound strange, is that it's such a big problem that we have to succeed. And I think there's increasing realization of the magnitude of the problem, which means more people are involved and there's more pressure towards finding a solution. I will just give a couple of examples. They're relating to the discussion before. So sometimes we hear numbers and we don't have a sense unless we compare them. So the cost is close to, of Alzheimer's disease in the US, is close to $200 billion a year, okay? So, and it will go to a trillion, as Maria said. So this was the cost of the war in Iraq. So in a few years, in 2050, where the projections refer to, if it's the case, it would cost us five wars like the war in Iraq. So imagine the country having five armies fighting at five different places in the world. So, and it's a bigger issue in developing countries because the population there is young and there's higher life expectancy more and more, and they do not have the infrastructure to deal with that. So, and Alzheimer's disease costs more than cardiovascular disease and cancer together. These things are becoming more and we're becoming more and more aware. And so there's a big demand from society. And that translates into effort. And more scientists are being recruited into this aspect of neuroscience, trying to find the solution. And there's more public health effort. So Maria can talk to the Alzheimer's Association being successful in increasing the funding considerably about this disease relatively recently. And this can certainly give a boost towards this direction. It's a difficult problem. For example, there was a lot of success, let's say, in HIV. I don't want to minimize it, but it's a virus, and we needed to find the right cocktail of antibiotics to kill it. But neurodegenerative diseases are very much linked with aging. So biologically speaking, and also there are many aspects in that, many different pathologies in the brain. So it's a difficult, biologically speaking, problem. But I think given the realization of the magnitude of the problem and the collective effort, we see, I mean, this conference is an example. Many scientists from all over the world working together. In the past, it was more individually driven research. Now it's all consortia and collaborations, and this also can definitely boost our ability to deal with it.
Thank you, and it's a great question. I'm optimistic for many reasons, but I'll keep it short because we've got a long way to go on this line. But I think first and foremost, it's important to remember that for decades, Alzheimer's and related dementias at the federal level, and our federal government is the largest funder of Alzheimer's and related dementias in the world. It was only funded to a $450 million measly dollars a year, okay, until 5 years ago. But imagine that we lived in Alzheimer's research funding with only $450 to give to all of the researchers around the United States. That is nothing. We were starving for dollars. And so innovation, out of the question, right? You have no money, what do? You fund conservative ideas over and over because you're afraid to go wrong. You have no money. Today, We have almost $2.4 billion a year going to Alzheimer's and related dementias. That will change things for all of us. It's going to change. We need to give it time. I know it's not going to happen tomorrow. It may not be next year. That happened for cancer. It happened for heart disease. It happened for HIV/AIDS. And over time, death rates have been going down for those diseases. That's fabulous. We may not have cured everything, and we may still be at an increased risk for cardiovascular disease, but we've reduced our risk dramatically. Even if half the population only follows those things, I understand that those are still things that happen. But knowing about that for heart health and brain health is going to change the game. I'm really excited about the fact that we're recognizing that lifestyle is a huge contributor to your brain health. That's finally come and have its day. In the future, I think we'll be treating dementia broadly, maybe not all dementias, but dementia broadly, including Alzheimer's, in a combination therapy approach that includes lifestyle and pharmacological approaches, because we've done it and successfully for other diseases, and I think we will have our day as well. That's what I'm excited about, and I think we're going to have blood-based markers in the near future that are going to be able to help us determine who's on that path so that we can start early and say, hey, we're going to be able to treat this as a manageable disease, not as something that's going to get to dementia. So we'll decrease your risk of dementia by doing X, Y, Z that include lifestyle and combination of pharmacological therapies. So I'm excited. I think that day is coming.
The reason I'm optimistic, thank you, Maria, the reason I am optimistic is because I look at the way this country conducted the war on cancer. And it, although that money has been questioned about the utility of it, it brought us today, just as Maria said, a decline in the death rates of cancer. But more importantly than that, we now have a very fundamental understanding of cancer, the cell biology of cancer. We understand why in detail, with all the genes and enzymes involved, why cells will proliferate uncontrollably. And that all came from the funding that went into it. And what's coming out of it are the therapies that are beginning to make big inroads in the cancer problem. Today, we understand very little about Alzheimer's disease. We understand very little about the fundamental cell biology, very little about why a cell dies. We know why they proliferate. We don't know why they die. So the reason that I am optimistic is because now, with the funding that we're talking about, we are going to be able to start to do the fundamental biology, the cell biology, the molecular biology that's needed to generate real treatments that are grounded in science. And that is that's where the cure is going to come from, in my opinion.
So on top of a better understanding and having more technologies and having a lot of advances in cardiovascular, cancer, genomics, all that, I'm very optimistic because now people with dementia has a voice. Caregivers have a voice. People in front are not the scientists, are the people that deeply care about this. And we need you on our side. We need the inspiration. We need your voice, because this is not a construct. This is very tangible. And so I'm very optimistic because I'm seeing you here.
This was a portion of a public conversation with leading national and international Alzheimer's researchers gathered in San Antonio for the inaugural South Texas Alzheimer's Conference, hosted by UT Health San Antonio's Glenn Biggs Institute for Alzheimer's and Neurodegenerative Diseases and the Alzheimer's Association. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. You can write to us with an email to texasmatters@tpr.org. You could also write directly on our show page on our website at tpr.org. And that's where you can listen to past Texas Matters episodes, and you can find us wherever you download your podcast. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.